with. This is broadcast number 594. This is Mae Bressel, April 25th, 1983, KAZU FM in Pacific Grove, California. 1 year ago this evening, we were talking about Antarctica. I was talking about large airports in Dallas and Fort Worth that could be used for mass extermination, removing people from population centers in the United States. An article in the New York Times, March 14th, 1982, Antarctica is a twilight zone, that it could be used for colonizations, for space colonies, for human beings who might live for extended periods aboard spacecraft. They would launch them from Antarctica. That's New York Times, March 14th, 1982. The article says this is the best place to murder your in-laws and get away with it. Send them up to space stations. Another story a year ago, March 14th, 1982, a map of Antarctica that was in the newspaper Argentine section is identical to the National Geographic map. In the New York Times, they had a map of what Argentina owns, and there's in this map Hitler's designated area. The National Geographic map was printed in 1957 and again in 1963 with Hitler's designated area. That is very important because I have talked last week about the John Kennedy assassination and Robert Morris and the Young Americans for Freedom who came from Munich, Germany, down to the Dallas area where Robert Morris funded them to take over the far-right organizations in the Southwest and then later move into Washington and around the country. Robert Morris was president of the University of Texas, and he presently lives outside of Princeton, New Jersey, working for the L5 Society with Gerard O'Neill to make the identical space stations that I did three broadcasts on Alternative 3. If you don't have those, I'll give you the numbers. You can contact me at home or write to me, and I'll send you the sheets if you want the bibliography of the sources of information. The same Robert Morris that was the chief counsel for Senator Joe McCarthy during the House Internal Subcommittee hearings, the witch hunts, the Robert Morris that worked with Carl Widenbach, otherwise known as Colonel Willoughby, the Robert Morris who funded the Young Americans for Freedom from Munich, Germany. He is working, he's, as I say, president of the University in Texas. He's working with the most fascist elements of our society from Europe abroad, and I'll give you some names later in the weeks to come. I was talking about the space. Antarctica is the model for the use of space colonization a year ago, and I just found out last week that Morris is one of the people working with Gerard O'Neill to get those space colonies going, which I said would be used for extermination. A year ago, I was talking about Hitler's escape route. On the call that I took before this program began, I mentioned the Police Gazette, January 1977. That is available. I had copies made, and with the printing and the postage, it's around $3. If you want to send a self-addressed stamped envelope, it's heavy. I'll send you a copy of that. In there, they had the ship that arrived July 8, 1945, that left Norway May the 2nd, and the possible escape route of Hitler. And when we get through with a year ago tonight, we'll go right into the subject of Hitler's diary, because what I was saying last year isn't far off from what is appearing, seems to appear in the diary right now. I talked about Children of Jonestown, how the U.S. military orders from Mr. Brzezinski said remove the identification of bodies and markers. President Carter and the National Security Advisor handled what they called batch consignments. And I also said a year ago that Mr. Brzezinski was instrumental in getting the Polish Pope from IG Farben and Solvay Chemical into the Vatican. And just a year ago, this last week, 3 weeks ago, there was an article in the New York Times and various newspapers around the European press on the role that Mr. Brzezinski played in engineering the Pope into the Vatican. I had that about 1 year ago, and also the use of Antarctica for the space stations. And there were other things we discussed, but that's the main tone because those things are still in the news today. And then I asked the question a year ago, that was April 25th, 1982, what if Grace Walden were sent away and not your mother-in-law regarding the Antarctica story? Now, Grace Walden was the woman at the rooming house where James Earl Ray was supposed to have fired the gun that killed Martin Luther King. And she said it was not James Earl Ray. And at the time that the House Select Committee was looking into the assassinations, Mark Lane went to a mental hospital in Tennessee and checked out Grace Walden. You remember that. And then he was going to have her sent down to Jonestown under the alias of a woman who was dead, possibly murdered. And there was correspondence found in Jonestown between Jim Jones and Mark Lane on the possibility of removing Grace Walden down to Jonestown. Now, that's a very important link to the use of South America to do away with primary witnesses to a trial. And I emphasized that last year and on many programs. And to update a story that is just mind-blowing for me, and a listener from Canada reminded me of this, on the anniversary of Martin Luther King's death, April the 4th, the broadcast I did this year, number 591, I talked about James Earl Ray and how he asked about four other people. He mentioned several people that were involved with him, and they were drug dealers. So they were into weapons and drug dealing, and he says they were involved in the scheme to kill Martin Luther King. And this came out of Penn Jones' newsletter, The Continuing Inquiry, and he got it from the Nashville, Tennessee, on November the 2nd, 1980. There were three names that he mentioned that I had on the tape: Carlos Miguel Hernandez, H-E-R-N-A-N-D-E-Z, David Gravier, G-R-A-I-V-E-R, and Randolph Irwin Rosenson, R-O-S-E-N-S-O-N. And the thing that interested me about Rosenson was that James Earl Ray said he had the name of Clyde Watts in his car, and Clyde Watts worked with General Walker, and the Munich military intelligence people from the Young Americans for Freedom that came to Robert Morris in the Dallas-Fort Worth area. And Young Americans for Freedom wasn't just Robert Morris. It was the who's who of people in power today. That's why it is so important to keep bringing this up. Well, I mentioned this and got a phone call from a world watcher up in Canada who subscribes to New Solidarity. It's put out by the National Labor Caucus, and some of their material is off the walls, and some is very important. We're not getting it elsewhere. And New Solidarity, March 21st, 1983, hadn't arrived the week that I did this broadcast. And there's a full-page article. Up in the corner is the picture of the Sterling National Bank, the banking for this international network of fascists, what I call the Odessa, the Nazi killers. The Sterling National Bank, I've referred to on other programs, with the money going into the Otto von Bolschwing setting up the TCI corporation that Helene von Damm worked for, that this began by siphoning money from this bank, and it was linked to Michael Sindona and the Vatican and the network of these people out of the Sterling National Bank in New York City and also in Boston. Now, they have a picture of the Sterling National Bank, which would tie into von Bolschwing and von Damm, and Mr. Rifkin and 20th Century Fox, that network I just described. Then they have three pictures of people that worked or linked to this. One is Robert Vesco. Now, he is very important to this whole story of working with Mr. William Casey of the CIA and the entire assassination team and with Bernie Kornfeld. Vesco's in one picture. It says Robert Vesco, $60 million. Then the next picture is Michael Sindona, tied to the story of the international network of laundering and narcotics and gun running. And Michael Sindona is $27 million. And then the third picture is David Graver's theft of $40 million. And it tells about his role. He was a financier from Argentina, the owner of the American Bank and Trust Company, and he was supposed to have been killed in an airplane crash, but allegedly the crash was fixed, and he went off to Madrid with money that he took out of Argentina that they thought he was representing the left or people wanting a break, and he was coming to this country with this money. Now, this article says that by 1967, Graver had money in, he had deposits of over $10 million in the World Commerce Bank of Nassau alone, whose president, Alvin Malnick, M-A-L-N-I-K, was a Lansky lieutenant. And he has them down in Nassau. Well, Paul Marcinkus, the banker for the Vatican and for Michael Sindona, was head of a bank down in the Bahamas in Nassau. And also, if Graver was Raoul, if he was Raoul, then it's one more piece of this huge puzzle. I'll do more on Graver later. But he's the man that James Earl Ray said was Raoul. Now, I pulled out an article from the Berkeley Barb going back to 1974, that's 9 years ago, where he claims that this man who used the name Raoul had bought him his Mustang, that they worked for right-wing paramilitary groups that had tried to kill Fidel Castro, that they gave him money, getaway money, and the high power, they told him to buy a high-powered rifle in Birmingham to put it in a certain boarding house at 422 and a half South Main Street, and Ray's fingerprints were on it. And Ray had gone from Los Angeles to New Orleans and to Mexico, and then he went back to Memphis, Tennessee, where he had never been. He was shown around with Raoul, the man named Raoul. Then he had left and gone to London and Portugal and back to London. He had passports and he had identifications, and as soon as he was in London arrested, he asked for Mr. Haynes, the CIA attorney in Texas. So David Graver, who is linked to Michael Sindona and the Sterling Bank and Robert Vesco, in a new long full-page story that, as I say, I will outline for you, is the Graver that was mentioned by James Earl Ray in 1974, now in 1983, shows up as a team member of the exact same teams that I've been referring to on the program. Now, on the anniversary of John Kennedy's assassination, 20th anniversary, I will be updating and tying the links of these various conspiracies every week together with specific references going to John Kennedy's assassination. But you will find in the next year or 2 years to come that all of these names and people come together, the same banks, the same names, the same people. This time it's Vesco, Sindona, and Graver, and before it was Graver and James Earl Ray. And then pretty soon you'll be able to see the path of how they interact and act together. I did want to do an entire program on Johnny Meyer, a fellow who's in Canada, used to work for the Howard Hughes Organization. I promised to do that. I will do it next week. There's just so much news that I had to cover a few of these other stories and update them for you. But next week I will do the Johnny Meyer story, at least a half hour or 20 minutes. He sent me a press release April 2nd from the Vancouver Sun. He's asking that he be kept in Canada and not be sent to Los Angeles. He was held for the 1974 murder of Alfred Wayne Netter. Now, that's 9 years ago, and the American DA in Los Angeles, they're pressing for him to stand a murder charge. The man who did the murder is long gone. The alleged killer is William McCrory, and another person, Gordon Hazelwood, was supposed to be involved. Now, all those people have had all the charges dropped, and they want to say that Johnny Meyer had a role in this, and they're harassing him. What he said at his press conference, he listed a number of political offenses which the U.S. is alleged to be punishing him for. Number one, he contradicted data on the testing programs of the Atomic Energy Commission that they were lying about. Two, he disclosed evidence of an in-camera meeting of the Senate Watergate Committee investigating staff, which was damaging to the Nixon administration. Three, he had business and personal relationships with the brother of President Richard Nixon. They want to get him for that. Four, he disclosed political payments made by the Central Intelligence Agency to U.S. politicians. And I have a name of those, all those patient people, Paul Exalt and Gerald Ford, and you can imagine the who's who that Howard Hughes was paying in the Congress. He has a list of those people that they were paying by the CIA. Next, he exposed the CIA agents who were infiltrating into friendly countries and trying to overthrow them. The suit said that extradition was persecution by the U.S. authorities and contrary to the Canadian Charter. Netter was stabbed to death at a Beverly Hills hotel room November 1974. The grand jury indicted three people, Meyer, Hazelwood, and William McCrory, the killer. And also this case ties into Mr. Bueller of the CIA, and I hinted about that. I'll go back to more later. Johnny Meyer has been fighting extradition, and they've dropped the charges on everyone else, but they seem to want to nail him, and he's had a miserable time. The trouble is, when you work for those people, it's hard to get out from under. When you've played all their games with them, then they know how to get you, and he's lucky he isn't shot. Very important story in the San Francisco Chronicle, not a wire services story today. April 25th, 1983, Stanford Fuhrer, Hoover Institution, the target of petitions. Now, isn't that about time? You know, this program of World Watches is played up in the Cupertino and the San Jose area, and I hope or wonder if any of the professors there listen on Monday nights. It's on from 9 to 10 there, or on Saturdays, because some way or other, they're catching on. 650 students have signed a petition. They object to the Hoover Institution of War, Revolution, and Peace, widely regarded as a conservative think tank, under attack from Stanford University, the faculty, and students. They said the institute is mixing politics with academic research. The Stanford campus has been there a long time. Herbert Hoover has his tower, a repository of Nazi documents, what do you call them, all the personal diaries of the Nazis, the Tsarists, the monarchies. This is the repository for the deposed monarchs and the fascist people that fled their fascist homeland, and put this stuff into the Hoover Tower. And out of there, the petition was signed out of Stanford by an English professor, Ronald Rebholz, R-E-B-H-O-L-Z, and a political science professor, David Manley. They said the Hoover Institution promotes people on the Ronald Reagan administration. The Stanford gives them, this year they got $4 million out of the Stanford's 8.4, out of the Hoover Institute's $8.4 million budget. And they object to funding the archives at the Hoover Tower. The pending appointments of two conservative Hoover fellows put onto the Stanford campus, Alvin Rabushka, R-A-B-U-S-H-K-A, and political science Gerald Dorfman. They object to them being in the Stanford political science department, and they want them, their ideology is too one-sided and not objective, and the students, 650, have signed petitions. They said the 43 people from the Hoover Institute have links to the present Ronald Reagan administration, including Philip Habib, special envoy to the Middle East, Daryl Trent, Deputy Secretary of Transportation, economist Milton Friedman, who's ruined every country he's touched, on the brink of bankruptcy, a total failure. And they mentioned former Richard Allen, security advisor, who's now a lobbyist for Japan. What galls me, said Professor Rebholz, is the Hoover trades on the reputation of Stanford University and the university for its right-wing position, because they say they're from Stanford. W. Glenn Campbell, the Hoover Institution executive director since 1959, was appointed by Ronald Reagan on the Board of Regents of the University of California. And it goes into the various people who have a one-sided political attitude, and they want them out, and they're signing petitions. Now, that is quite a change. I never could understand how they got away with so much propaganda and lies and experts. And after they go after the Stanford Institute, they had to go after Harvard with Fritz Kramer's protege, Henry Kissinger, and Mr. Richard Pipes, and the whole propaganda for the Cold War and the Hot War, World War III, coming out of Stanford and Harvard particularly. Brown and Yale make the spies, but the mouthpieces are Stanford and Harvard that make the main policies of the National Security Council. Now, there's a picture in the New York Daily News this week of Ron's brother paying a visit to the Pope. This is April 13th, 1983. J. Neil Reagan, whose nickname is Moon, probably for Reverend Moon, the 74-year-old brother of President Reagan, and his wife Beth took time from a helter-skelter, they get that from the Manson family, not from the Beatles, for their European trip to spend a half hour with Pope John in the Vatican. Reagan, a devout Catholic and a daily churchgoer, brought along four other persons to a private audience in the Papal Library, including Daniel D. Gilbert, president of Eureka College in Illinois. Both the Reagan brothers are graduates of Eureka. Ron got his degree in 1932. Moon got his a year later, he's at Board of Trustees, graduated in 1933. Now, this is a very important article for me because I said that I remembered, and I cannot be accused of having a bad memory, that long before Ronald Reagan took the position of president or even as governor, that way back in his early youth or in his childhood, he was a Catholic and he was hiding that early Catholic background. And it would be interesting to see one, his brother Moon, whether they were born Catholic, because at the time of the inauguration, he threw out the rabbi and the priest and the churchman. He used Mr. Moomau, his former football player friend from California, his pastor, but he doesn't go to church on Sundays and he has no overt affiliation. But every position he's made has been a Sovereign Military Order of Malta, a Vatican position, not every, but almost all. I think of J. Peter Grace and Helene Von Damme and William Casey, and I've run down the cabinet, the Buckleys, and the people who are Catholics knighted by the Vatican, Mr. Clark, with their strong links to the Pope. And now his brother is visiting the Pope and is a devout Catholic. He goes every day like John DeLorean went every day to Cardinal Cook when he's around. Now, on broadcast number 588, that was March 14th, I had a chronology of those very important names of Germans and Nazis and people, the chronology of their careers that overlapped. And in 1937, I mentioned Ronald Reagan was brought to Hollywood by Music Corporation of America from his fundamentalist Christian college in Eureka, a 300-student campus, and taken to Warner Brothers. He had a little interim with his radio program in Illinois. But the main key to Ronald Reagan is that fundamentalist background and who was at the college with him. And when he went to Hollywood and was a registered Democrat, and then other registered Democrats like Joe McCarthy switched, or the president of General Electric, they were Democrats, and they suddenly switched and were Republicans and were very far-right fundamentalist Christian, devout, I mean political fanatic Christians, that's what I mean. And the way that Reagan carries on his crusade, he's going to beg for money for the bloodbath of Central America. You couldn't do a better job if you had the Inquisition of the Crusades. So the purpose of the trip of the brother was to collect money for the University of Eureka to have a memorial to Ronald Reagan. He's going around to the Vatican and then to Japan to raise funds. The initial goal of his brother is to raise $5 million for Ronald Reagan. Well, the Vatican is in trouble and being sued for a lot of money it lost. It's a hard one to tap, but it's interesting that he was there with the Pope, and I would just love to have heard the conversations that were going on. Real quickly, and not too much time, I will do more later. The Hitler Diaries appeared. They reminded me of the pumpkin papers of Alger Hiss that were found out in a field by Whitaker Chambers, the film, the microfilm. I don't believe for a minute that they were real. I think you'll hear more about being a fraud, but the question is, why now and who? Not are they or not, are they not a fraud? First, you, Trevor Roper, said they were authentic. That's the first clue that they're a fraud, because he's the one that lied about the death of Hitler. He's sent by Winston Churchill to find out if Hitler was dead, and he wrote the story on the death of Hitler, I think, several months before the bunker was even opened up and there wasn't a trace of Hitler. These papers were found, no small amount, 60 volumes, Mark Der Fuhrer, found in a hayloft in Eastern Europe instead of flying the plane west, where Reinhard Gehlen salted away his papers, and Mr. von Braun and Walter Dornberger and the Punnemann scientists, they were all putting away their papers for the Allies, for the Americans to take them into their arms. Can you imagine 60 volumes? Now, the fellow who allegedly flew them, he wasn't killed, and the volumes are intact, and they were clearly marked Der Fuhrer. He's in Switzerland, and something came to my mind today that I'll play around with you. I was discussing this subject with a person who believes that he saw Adolf Hitler. And Hitler did not write in pen and ink. He wrote in pencil, but he didn't write much. He dictated. And as I say, the fellow who has these who flew the diaries out, who they're protecting, the various names they're protecting, he's in Switzerland. And I had this very weird idea that what the last time I heard where Hitler was when he left his birthday party in Brazil, when he was with Mr. Wagner, the war criminal, that he went on to Switzerland. And I wonder if he had time during the years to dictate, and so that the writing is fake, but the ideas are his memory of the incidences he's had a long time. So what they're finding is the information is confusing because it's so detailed and it could only come from Adolf Hitler himself. What if since 1945, or arriving down in Argentina on the date that I gave you before, what if he was having somebody write these things? Because they only could come from his head. And the allegedly discovery of them, a man looked for them 3 years, you find them in 1981 in a hayloft, and then started putting a book together. I doubt the whole story of that, but it'd be interesting to know about the pilot who's still alive, General Hans Bauer, B-A-U-E-R. And Mr. Hindemann started searching for them, but Mr. Bauer is in Switzerland. And I wonder if Adolf is in Switzerland, and these were released because they had nothing to say about the extermination camps. Hitler wouldn't say, put the Jews on a boat and sink them. That would be too expensive. You can put 10,000 Jews in one room smaller than a basketball, where the basketball games or football, a stadium, and kill 10,000 with gas and bring in 10,000 more in an hour or two. That would be ridiculous to sink all your own boats for a bunch of Jews. That doesn't even make sense. But there's so many details, 60 volumes, and Adolf may have had time to dictate these and somebody else wrote them so that they're Adolf's head and somebody else's pen, because now you, Trevor Roper, is saying, well, half true. I think the half is that possibly he dictated them, and the other half is that he didn't write them. Somebody else wrote them, and the ideas were his, and that's where they came from. They certainly weren't anywhere else, and they could have come up from Argentina and Brazil, up with Adolf, and he had them all these years working on them. Now, there's another book coming out, another expert, David Irving, a British author, and he's going to write about the doctor that Hitler had, Dr. Theodor Morell. I don't believe a bit of that. I think that these stories that he was drugged and all of it, that he was had leeches out of jars put into his ears and all these chemicals. Reading the directives he gave during the war and up to the end of the war and how he conducted himself, he seemed to have many more rockers going about him than people give him credit for. And I don't believe for a minute. I think that the legends get distorted with these telltale stories that happen later. This is a story in the Washington Post. Italy tries, but the mafia has setbacks. The important point about this story is that last week, 12 important people were murdered involved with the mafia. Now, Italy is trying to locate the largest drug-running, gun-running mafia arrest outside of Milan that was in the building of the Banco Ambrosiano that works with the Vatican. They're trying to untangle that affair, and every week more people are being gunned down in Italy. Now, one of them that was murdered this last week was Antonio Sorci, S-O-R-C-I. He's 78 years old. They killed him and his son. He was a former lieutenant of Charles Lucky Luciano. Sorci was known as Nino the Rich. Now, Lucky Luciano was put in Italy by Tom Dewey, and Murder Incorporated's top boss was put over there to help with the drug dealing and distribution of mafia turf when World War II was over. Why would you gun down a 78-year-old man and his son last week? Because they might know more about the Milan-Vatican connections, the Banco Ambrosiano. If anybody would, he would. But as I say, there were 12 people killed in 24 hours last week in Italy. In 1982, there were 300 mafia murders. In 1983, so far, 60. But 12 in the last 24 hours, and one goes to Lucky Luciana, who is a member of our CIA, worked with the CIA and Murder Incorporated, sent over to Italy. So they're dying pretty fast over there. When you get a conclusion that a case is solved or you have the suspects, you don't know who worked with Aja in that part of the country, because, as I say, if 12 are killed in 24 hours and one worked with Luciana, they're covering the traces pretty fast. There's another big story breaking, and that has to do with Michael Townley. That's the fellow that killed Orlando Letelier for the CIA when George Bush was director of the CIA. Now he's wanted down in Argentina for murdering General Carlos Prats Gonzalez, P-R-A-T-S, Gonzalez, G-O-N-Z-A-L-E-Z. Now, he was the head of the Chilean army. He fled when Allende was murdered. He was blown up in a car with his wife. And Michael Townley killed them in Argentina, then he went back to Chile by way of Paraguay, and then came to the United States and killed Orlando Letelier in Washington, D.C. And the important thing is that when he was charged with the murder of Letelier, The CIA and the Justice Department knew the identical murder that he did down in South America earlier of Carlos Gonzalez, but the condition of getting Townley arrested on the Letelier murder was that they wouldn't bring up the other two murders. Now, that's the guy that I said worked at Colonial Dignitat, quartering people alive for the top Nazi war criminals and torturing them for the DINA Argentine police. He was almost ready to be paroled from America. We may send him down there, and then they may release him. Michael Townley, family, he worked for Ford Motor Company, NASA, and so forth, high society from the United States government. They want him for an identical murder that took place earlier. Well, I have more stories before the half hour, but I won't have a chance to do those. We'll have to do them next week. We'll take a one-minute break and ask for some money for the station and then continue with this broadcast.